I'm sure you can all hear me. thank you, Gloucester Writers Center, and thank you, Annie, so much for all you do for the community. And Endicott is so excited to be forging this relationship with you. It's been so great for our students, and it has taken us, I think, far too long to get our amazing poets here to read tonight. So this is a really exciting event to have Dan Sklar and Doug Holder and two of our poetry students reading here. I think what I'm going to do is introduce Dan, and then I'll introduce Doug when it's your turn. But I think we'll start with Dan Sklar, because really the reason we're all here tonight at Endicott is because of Dan Sklar. The reason I teach at Endicott is because of Dan. The reason the two students you're going to hear read tonight are reading poetry tonight is because of Dan. The reason Doug is at Endicott is because of Dan. The reason we're all writing is because of Dan. Dan is an amazing poet, as you'll hear. One of his most recent poems, Flying Cats, has just been nominated for a Pushcart. He's won many prizes. He began life really, though, as a playwright and a taxi driver, I have to say. Last year, he had a play in Boston, I think, Lycanthropy. And now isn't Hack happening now? Just happened in Newburyport. If you haven't had a chance to see any of his plays produced, his people actually talk like people. They're funny, they're smart, they're provocative, they're as interesting and sort of gripping as his poetry. As well as being an inspirational poet, though, if you look around the room and you see how many young people are here tonight, that really is because of Dan. He is a captivating, charismatic, and inspirational teacher that all of my students say is sort of the teacher that has changed their lives. So I think we're so fortunate to have Dan reading here tonight. Sorry to be over the time, but it's true, Dan.
Thank you, Charlotte. I'm glad you stopped there, because I was going to get faint back there. Wow, it is great to see you all here tonight. And thank you to the Cultural Center, for the Writing Center, for having us. And I brought you here. I did, because I think you are great. And that's why I recommended all of you. So there's a reason to it, for it. That's not true. You could do it. I will start with the poem "Flying Cats Actually Swooping," because I was watching a TV show about what the Earth would be like if humans were suddenly gone, and what would happen to the Earth. And I don't know, has anyone ever seen that show? It was a whole series, and it was fascinating. And I was falling asleep during one of them, and then I heard someone say, "In the future, there will be flying cats." And I perked right up. Actually, swooping. More like flying squirrels. So I came up with this poem. In the future, there will be flying cats, actually swooping cats, as they will evolve and move up into the trees and abandon buildings. I want to see a world where cats swoop. I want to live in a world where there are flying cats, and one lands on your shoulder and meows and does a little cat dance up there and digs its nails in, but not enough to hurt. And a cat will sit in a canoe with you, and maybe other cats will swoop in, meow, and fly back into the trees. Sometimes they catch flying squirrels, but not too often. This is the future I'm thinking of. Flying cats in canoes and bicycles. Sometimes when you're riding a bike, a flying cat will land on your back and sit down, look around, knead your back a little, then fly off. In the future, the principal means of transportation will be horses and horse-drawn things and bicycles and walking and trolley cars and slow trains. Not too many motors for the most part. People will want to go slowly to places because they want to see things and think about them. And there is no hurry in the future. There is no hurry in the future. There are no clocks. People figure out time by the sun and how they feel about it. There will be a lot of looking at the sky and stars. It will be a common activity. There will be many tents. People will spend more time in tents, but mostly they will be out of doors, which would be better than indoors, even for old people. Old people will sit outside most of the time, and a cat will land in their lap, and they will pet the cat, and the cat will purr, and this will add many out-of-door, sky-looking-at years to their lives. There will be many hammocks in the future, set up for the old folks when they need to take naps. And when it's time for them to die, and they will know when, they will climb into a hammock and die in the cool shade on a summer's day. Thank you, thank you. You don't have to clap after each one, because you might not clap, and then I'll feel like, or you might be like, well, I don't think I'm going to clap. So you can wait till the end, but unless you're totally, you know, moved. But thank you for that. I was thinking about the dystopia, you know, all the dystopias movies and the books, which I love. But I was thinking maybe it's not going to be like that. Maybe it'll just be more primitive, like in that other book that went back to the primitive. I think it was not 1984, the other one. Aldous Huxley. Brave New World, yeah. Yeah, there was the primitive section of that. I was thinking about offices. You know how, and if you took the roof off the office buildings and could look down on the people doing things, it would look like they're just kind of scurrying around and not really doing anything. So I wrote this poem from that point of view called Offices. If I can find it here. Well, I'll do it from this one. Everyone is working in their office. Everyone is working in their office typing something, reading something, talking on the phone with someone. Everyone is working in their offices, getting up, walking around, looking out the window, talking to other people in other offices. Everyone is working in their office, and the people who do not have an office would like to have one. When they would get up, and they would get up and go to meetings and meeting rooms or other offices. And it is raining, and they look at the rain. They look at the pictures on the wall of the girl holding up the Peugeot bicycle. They have meetings and close the door. They have other meetings and close that door. They look through the calendars. They have these schedule books that they write other meetings in them. That's it. That's the point. This is that. Thank you. You don't have to. Sometimes I feel like that, you know, in our offices. This one I want some help with, if you don't mind. This is called, I don't know if you've ever heard of the actor. Even if you didn't, it doesn't matter. His name is Ben Gazzara. Ben Gazzara. And I was thinking one day about that movie, The Big Lebowski. And so I was thinking about Big Lebowski and Ben Gazzara. And I realized I really like the name Ben Gazzara. I would rather have that name. So what I'd like you to do is, whenever I point to you, say Ben Gazzara, okay? Let's try it. You ready?
Ben Gazzara.
Thank you. Okay. This is one of those poems I hate when I go to a poetry reading. Because I don't want to get it. I don't want to be involved in anything. But so if you don't want to, you don't have to. It's called Ben Gazzara Says It All. You wanted to be an actor because of a man with the best name in the world. This is a man whose voice sounds like nothing else but man. You wanted that voice, that name, when said anything it was true, even if it wasn't. Would stand there, black hair, and tell you some things. Sometimes you spend all day outside listening to birds and thinking about
Ben's.
It's like he knows something you don't know. Even though you do, he knows it better.
Ben's
knows it better than you. What are you doing out there in the sunshine? Listening to birds, watching the cat, and thinking about
Ben's.
Famous, but not too famous. Famous enough. Any movie where looks into your eyes and tells you a few things. You've got to think like a cat. It's better to write about what we than what will get you in trouble with authorities. And when you write a play, you think of you would be you. What would Ben? What would? In fact, you have a cat named. And one named John Cassavetes. You would like to get drunk with. And you know he wouldn't kill you. He couldn't kill anyone. Is an actor and a pussycat. He wears that white suit, white shoes, and red shirt untucked in the Big Lebowski and looks straight into the camera. Bonfire, beach party night. Hello, dude. Thanks for coming. I'm Jackie Treehorn. Yeah, that's it. You have to know. You have to know that movie, that scene where he just looks into the camera. I'm Jackie Treehorn. Okay, this is one I want to read to some musicians in the audience, and I was a member of two bands once. I played drums in two bands. And if I can find it here. Yeah, here it is. Two bands. And they were so different playing in these bands. It was so different. And I'm going to read this to you, which talks about one band and then the other band. It's called Two Bands. Once I used to play in two bands. One band, black guys, played jazz, all improvisation. The other band played swing. Old white guys. Only the notes on the sheet music. No improvisation. Except sometimes. At breaks, the jazz band would find an alley or parking lot or go behind the club to smoke marijuana. When they came back, what they did with time, Albert Einstein or Rod Serling could never explain. They never asked me to smoke marijuana with them, because I was the drummer they called when the regular drummer couldn't make it. And there was no one else. The swing band, at breaks, smoked cigars and complained about how immigrants, Democrats, unions, and cats were ruining the country. That's true. That is true. Except for the cats part. But it was always unions, Democrats, and what was the other one? Immigrants. The black guys just got high. But they never asked me to go out with them. I was kind of, you know, hurt. Not that hurt, but I was a little hurt. Right. Henri Smith. You ever see Henri Smith? He was one of the guys. He plays a lot around here. Anyway, I'll just do a couple more. These are short. This is called What I Want. Sometimes I want to be out of touch. I do not want to know what is going on. I do not want information. I don't want information. I want relationships. I do not want to believe one thing because there are too many things to believe. I don't want to be more productive. You know, I want to walk across Spain to come to some little town where men drink small glasses of beer at a cafe and sweat. It's true. Oh, how am I doing on time? Okay. This is another short one in that style. I guess I probably wrote it around the same time, called I Mean It. I mean it. I could live in a third world country, in a hut or something. I don't need to write in a powerful nation. I don't even believe in powerful nations anyway. I could live in Honduras, say, or on a beach, live on beans and rice. I could live in a third world country with a bicycle, no doctor's appointments. I could live in a third world country that has no army, where I could write nothing, walk and bike to places and write nothing, and send the things I write nowhere. Okay, this one is, I've never read this before. My father, God bless him, he's 90 years old, and he's a bit of a character. But I guess if you're 90, you're allowed to be a character, right? You become a character. So he loves Norman Mailer. Everything is Norman Mailer with this guy, you know. He's always talking about Norman Mailer. And so he was in the hospital one day, and I said, Dad, look, they wrote a little article about one of my plays in the Boston Globe, in a review. And I swear to God, he said, you should read Norman Mailer. He didn't. I totally laughed. I laughed because these guys are characters. So this is called Norman Mailer. My father reads Norman Mailer books and tells me all about Norman Mailer. He reads about in the Sunday paper when Norman Mailer died and how he saw Norman Mailer interviewed on TV and how Norman Mailer writes in a room and cannot be disturbed and the room gets to be a mess and why he writes and things he writes and the fact that he's from Brooklyn too and the same age and tough guy too. And at 85, after major stomach surgery, my father reads the Boston Globe Sunday supplement about Norman Mailer and about all his different wives and books and declarations filled with the things he declared about life and its meaning. Norman Mailer, the last wild liberal with pictures of him boxing, running for mayor of New York City, debating William F. Buckley Jr., and my father loves to tell me about Norman Mailer. And when there's a short review in the Boston Globe of my one-act play, my father reads it and he loves to read about Norman Mailer and talk about Norman Mailer, how he writes and talks and tells me that I should write a biography of Norman Mailer. And I should write about Norman Mailer, and I should write like Norman Mailer. That's it.
I can see Norman Mailer's influence.
Oh, is that right? God. All right, I'll just do one or two more. This one is, I'll just do two more. I was supposed to go to a conference this summer, an educational conference, and I was chosen to do a speaking thing, you know, and have a special thing and talk about creative writing and teaching creative writing and everything. And I sent in a big proposal and wrote up a major thing about it, and they accepted it. And then the day came for me to go, and I didn't feel like going. I didn't go. I was totally irresponsible. But it takes character to be irresponsible. I've been trying to be irresponsible my whole life. And I finally did it. But you know what? Then I thought about it. I thought, well, they'll say, oh, he didn't show. And that'd be it. That'd be it. No one would care. They'd just move on. In fact, they'd be happy I didn't show. So I wrote this called Conference No Show. Your name is on the list. They have a name tag for you on the registration table. They have a room reserved for you with chairs and a whiteboard and a podium and a bottle of cold water for your presentation. They have the title of your talk and workshop printed in the handsome pamphlet of events, and it's on the marquee. Some attendees of the conference who find your title and description interesting are planning to see it. You are a no-show. Your name tag is the only one left on the table. People choose another presentation or plan to leave early. Maybe someone wonders for a split second what it was. Maybe not. Maybe it is better to be a no-show sometimes. The folks running the conference say to each other, he's a no-show, and are secretly pleased. In some ways, you are glad to be a no-show. Someone has to be a no-show. What do the no-shows do when they do not show? Why are they no-shows? Why did they even apply and send in their paper and check and Why are they gone? Where do they go? No-shows are not there. When you are dead, you are a permanent no-show. In fact, when I die, I just say, oh, he's a no-show. There comes a time in everyone's life when you have to be a no-show, and the people will think you are irresponsible and feel superior to you. I mean, after all, they showed. They were responsible. Showing is the least you can do. They were responsible, and maybe we need no-shows so everyone else can feel good in their responsibility. Someone has to keep hotel workers employed. Someone has to be committed to the conference. They put on their name tag, saw the keynote speaker, went to the talks or workshops, took notes, gave their talk or workshop, and they were convinced about whatever they were convinced about. Had lunch and collegial conversation about how wonderful technology is in the classroom. Maybe ate too much. There was a lot of food, and all agreed it was very good. When the afternoon sessions are through, they get into their cars and head home feeling responsible and confident in what they do and believe in. They feel accomplished, successful, and quite pleased with themselves, as well they should be. They are contributing to their field and education and society. There are as many reasons why the no-show doesn't show as there are no-shows. For me, I want to sit outside and watch the birds and sky and grass and trees and June sunshine. And you know, I'm deeply into Crime and Punishment and Raskolnikov and how they blame it on the house painter who even confesses. After all, Russians just want to suffer. And besides, the cat and I want to be outside all the time, and that is what it has come to. I have basically become a cat. You have to let out and have nothing to prove and do not need to convince anybody of anything. I think that's a good place to stop. That's a good place.
Wondering if we should have a request hour, because Dan has this poem I love about, and I can't ever remember its title. You know the one where it's about you are the kind of poet who rides his bike and doesn't get prizes, and you list all the prizes that you don't get.
Oh, yes.
I put it right up there with the no-show. I love the no-show. Okay, so now you've had a little flavor of why Endicott is a great place to be from Dan, and now here's our second newer reason, Doug. Doug, how long? You were an adjunct before. Well, you're still an adjunct, but you've been at Endicott.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read a list of some of the titles of Doug's books, because they're great titles. A lot of them have food and eating in them in sort of peculiar ways. So the most recent one is Eating Grief at 3 a.m. A lot of things happen at the Au Bon Pain, not death, though, right?
No one's died.
One title is No One's Died at the Au Bon Pain. Another favorite title of mine is The Man in the Booth at the Midtown Tunnel. One of the things that I think there's one, Poems from the Left Bank. There's Somerville is the Paris.
Yeah,
Somerville is the Paris of
New England.
Yes, of all of New England. I love that. Doug not only is an amazing poet, he's sort of the connector of poets in Boston, Somerville, Cambridge, the North Shore, New England, and in fact, you go far beyond New England now. The list of people he's interviewed, I was trying to get some names off the web, there are too many to list. Many from very famous people to smaller people that you might never have heard of. The interviews are always great because you take the time to find out about the person, you read about them, you ask them penetrating and sometimes embarrassing questions about their past, and the answers are always interesting. One of the things that I really value about you, Doug, is your generosity and how interested you are in other people, other writers, and of course, our students. So I'm so excited to hear you read tonight.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. Thank you, Dan, for getting me a job. I needed it. And it's great to be part of the Endicott community. So I got a new book out, Eating Grief at 3 a.m. It has an interesting backstory to it. The publisher and I said, look, I used to eat at Bickford's when I lived in New York, and it's sort of a hole in the wall, you know, junkies, prostitutes, all kinds of stuff. And a lot of beat poets actually used to hang out there, and in the 50s and 60s. But what I was going to say is that, so I want to use a line from Allen Ginsberg's poem, Eating Grief at Bickford's. So he says, and I'm going to use a nocturnal image of Bickford's restaurant in New York City. So he said, well, he's a lawyer, so he said, well, you've got to go to the website and ask permission for the picture. So the guy says, all right, send me the manuscript too. I send him the picture of Bickford's. He says, not only can you not use the picture, you can't use the name Bickford's. He says, because in your poem you said there's a fly in the soup and there's a threadbare tables. And so, and we all know how, you know, Bickford's is like, you know, the height of dining, right? And so I'm looking on his website, and it has all these literary quotes from like Hemingway and all these great authors, and they're saying threadbare tables, junkies, alcoholics, all this stuff. So I wrote him back, and I said, you know, this is a lot more defaming than anything I would, you know, put in. Then I noticed, and the website, it was all taken down. But anyway, I didn't want to go, you know, if the guy wants to be an idiot, he has money, he can take me in. So I changed it to Eating Grief at 3 a.m., which I think is pretty good, too, because, you know, if you're at 3 a.m. and you're in a diner like this guy is, it's probably something going on, you know, a little angst happening there. And so I think Eating Grief at 3 a.m. was a good substitute. So anyway, I'll read you the title poem, Eating Grief at Bickford's. So I didn't give it all up, right? I just didn't put it on the title page. There are no places anymore when I can sit at a threadbare table, pick at the crumbs on my plate and wipe the white dust from my pitch black shirt. The old men who used to spout Marxist rants from the cracked porcelain of their cups are gone. The boiling water, ketchup soup, the mustard sandwich they used to relish, all that so lean cuisine. Oh, hunchback in the corner, your lonely reflection in the glass of water. And Tennessee Williams Blanche eyes me through her grilled cheese, past the sugar, she teases. Maynard, the queer late night security guard, his policeman's hat draped on his head, looking like a sacrilegious rake, his countless renditions of defending his honor in the amorous, crazed embraces of muscular young men, how he protests too much, too much. The discarded men, blue belt blazers shedding their threads, outcasts with newspapers, stains of baked beans on their lapels, fingering a piece of passionless cod, lulled by their own murmur. Here's when I was in New York in 1973, and I was coming back with my friend. I was kind of young and foolish, and I got mugged, and it was a big experience. So I'll read you this. The mugging, Times Square, 1973. New Year's, I drank quarter beers and lived in a delirium of lights. The flash of the flash in the pan, the hooker and the tourist whores working the opposite side of the street and running down the dark alleyway, the sucker punch, the spray of American Express checks flapping to the ground, my face on the pavement, meeting a winding stream of my own blood, the war whoops of the 125th Street savage skulls, and my face in the YMCA mirror, a purple distorted bruise, an imposter, a face I would never lose. Well, here we have Thanksgiving come up, so I think I'll read a Thanksgiving poem. It's called Great Hatred in a Little Room. Picture a scene around the small table, the players' hands mangled into callous knots, their smiles malicious slits of incisors. A round table, perhaps. At times, their shoes touch below but retreat as fast as they say hello, each jockeying for their say, and the nodding graybeards acknowledge nothing that is said. There is the barb and the bluster, then the handshake, momentary slippery, then tight as a snake, and then the end is no more than the beginning. What you give, no one will take. I love Thanksgiving. There was a show that some of you remember, some of you won't. It was Father Knows Best, and it was the 1950s housewife and this father, you know, he'd come home, you know, he'd get out of a suit and change into a sports jacket, and then he ran everything, you know. It was like 1950s America. So I wrote this poem called Father Knows Best, Mother Does the Rest. The bland tyranny of the cardigan sweater, his smile creased in brutal condescension, mother corseted in apron strings, Bud, with a greaser's black defiant lock, rushes to the freedom of the front door. Father calls Princess, and she arrives dancing with the dog with an anxious, scripted, girlish giggle. And don't you think they would like to kill him just a little? Now, I have a cat poem, but of course, you know, it's sort of cynical cat. I love cats, though. I really do. I have a cat that licks my bald head every morning. Its curiosity killed the cat. A cat, a house cat escaped, ran a bit too far, died under the maw of a foreign car. Why did he leave his cushioned seat for something so abstract on the street? Just before he was hit, sniffing the pavement for some arcane scent, I wondered, what was his holy grail that made him slap his tail? We all had bad elementary school teachers, and, you know, so I had an art teacher, I think, you know, I found out much later, you know, what her story was. She was always miserable, and someone I met many years later was actually a roomer of hers, you know, and she used to rent rooms in the town. So I wrote this poem called Mrs. Plant. An art teacher at our elementary school, her face a painting that she worked on for a long time. An angry mask of red lips and rouge, disappointment sinking her cheeks. She passed the mimeograph sheets. At night, I imagine she sat with an arthritic cat in a shot glass, screaming at the reproductions of her walls. Did she recall when she was clad in black, and oh so tragic and enigmatic, taking feverish notes by the paintings on the Martin's walls? Walking back to her cold water flat, sketches a love note stuffed in the pocket of her winter coat. You know, I don't like, morning bird song, and I'm not into nature. You know, nature to me is like birds eating worms and worms eating other worms. It's like a supermarket. Morning bird song is a poem I wrote. I hate it, the cloying, cheap chirp that you are enjoying, the cheerful and blooded melody amidst the nuclear plumes, yet the second wave of monstrous waves. There you are, out on a limb, you tweeting twits, you avian nitwits. You ruffle my feathers, dropping your turds at dawn on my manicured suburban lawn, singing insanely, oh, the pain, the pain. At dawn, both my cat and I stare at the sky with ravenous eyes, helpless as you belt out your morning cries. Now, here's a funny poem, okay? Doesn't that throw the pressure? You know, it's tough being a writer. Even when I was born, my father called me a treasure and tried to bury me. And the job's the key to keep afloat, the orange juice factory, canned, couldn't concentrate. The rundown flats, the impoverished streets, no one asked you the time, they just stole your fake Rolex. The solitary meals, the waiter charging the extra for the fly in the soup. The dead silence of the mandarins after translating the works of Eliot into English. And take my creative partner, please. Let's see what I... Mashed potatoes. When I create you, it will be a land of milk and gravy. You will be born with a silver spoon in your maw, I will sculpt smooth edifices with you. I will transform your bland mountains to rolling hills, an eclectic landscape. I will look down at my utopia, good enough to eat. And finally, I'll read you one more. Harvard Square Theater, the last picture show. The Harvard Square Theater, I went to many for many years, and it closed. And it's like actually no first-run movie theater anymore. There's the Brattle, but I used to go there. We used to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I used to go to all the, you know, Last Tango in Paris, all the movies. On a hot day, and it was air-conditioned. You can go in there and, you know, just hang out. I miss it a lot. So this is Harvard Square, the last picture show. To spend the dog days in the darkened theater, my last tango in Paris, respite from the heat. The midnight mass of the faithful, the rituals, the memorized chants to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I will grab a beer from the ghost of the Worst House, then get a seat in the back, the flickering of the dark cinema, a two-hour bomb before I hit the street, the hot street, then it's gone. Thank you.
Two more readers, Megan and Emily, and I'm not sure which one of them wants to go first. Should we go do it in order of seniority? So Megan and then Em?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Megan Perkins is a senior at Endicott College. She's just back, in my mind, from New Zealand. And she's all of our students are interesting, but she's interesting because her great interest is ecology and fiction, and she's very interested in trying to write what she calls eco-fiction. And so I don't know, I think you're going to read poetry tonight, is that right? Yeah. But I'm very interested in what's going to happen with you in your future. I think very interesting novels are going to come out of your, you know, sort of deep abiding various interests, contrasting interests. So come on up.
Everyone. Thank you for that introduction, and I want to thank Annie and the Gloucester Writer Center for having me here tonight, and also I would like to thank Professor Holder and Professor Sklar for helping me publish a poetry book through the Endicott Young Poet Series, and I will read you the title poem, which is called The Girl Who Wore Sunshine. I think of feet when I think of Disney. I see high socks and white sneakers and cracks that could break my mother's back, plus a toenail. The wheels of my stroller dodge hot dogs and shadows of giant fuzzy creatures. Looking up at the magic burns my eyes, so I squint beneath my hat and my sunflower yellow shirt. The girl who wore sunshine but could never look it in the eye. Okay. So that's a title poem. I don't have much explanation for my poem, so I'm just going to dive right in there. All right, good. Well, look at you with your passion fruit lips and your fire engine dress that say, look at me, I am a woman, and make the men with their boyish grins check you up and check you down, down, down to the ground, down, slow, dance hot, and baby, don't you stop. Dance up, dance down, dress up, pants down. Look at you, trying to sew back the dress that you never wanted torn. All right. I'll move on to Get Out While You Still Can. Our town is built on a graveyard. The Boonie Wraiths are isolated except for their overconfidence and their unlived lives. We rotate around the one Cumberland Farms where kids stop in before school, the two highway exits that only locals use, and the three stoplights that maintain the rush hour of locals getting on the two highway ramps and the kids stopping in the one Cumberland Farms before school. Our only claim to fame is the Westminster Cracker Factory, the little red colonial building printed on plastic oyster cracker wrappers. The company has moved on and abandoned its birthplace, but we remain grounded in its presence. We keep its front neatly painted. The chemical smell of a successful escape pollutes the air. Its sides gape open with scars of water erosion. Drip, drip, drip goes our purpose. for we are the world, hailing from a regional high school of 759. We come bearing gifts of marijuana and beer. We are bored yet proud. We are the shit. Don't fuck with us. We are better than you. Hell yeah, we have a Dunkin' Donuts on the side of the highway, and the grand opening of the nearest subway within 20 miles was just last year. We are still pushing for Mickey D's. We are the world of pointless things. Thanks, Chloe. Thank you. No. Thank you. You don't have to applaud after every poem, just like Professor Sklar said, but thank you. It's appreciated. The next poem is called Take No Prisoners. He is no magic bunny. He is a thief. How else do you think he got such a pocket watch? He can speak, he can think, same as any human. So we shall hold him to judicial standards. The thief must go to jail. No, no, no. He will not be your pet. He will not make you money on some tour around the country. I don't care if he wears a vest and a jacket. He is a thief, not a spectacle. Slap the irons on his wrist, boys. We don't care if you're late, however important the date. You have the right to remain silent. Here's a donut. It'll make you bigger. And I'm glad you thought that was funny, Professor. This one is called Glass Slippers. Take me home, moldy pumpkin carriage. It's not midnight yet, but I'd much prefer to leave this ball. The prince got so pissy when I showed up late in my jeans and leather jacket and rummaged through the trash to recycle the champagne flutes. He told me I was an embarrassment because I didn't dress all dapper in the petticoats of death. I told him he should be embarrassed if I had. What do guys talk about in those taverns anyways? Oh, how I wish my girl would prick her finger on a needle or let seven men work for their keep while she sings to the birds all day. Indeed, what a wonderful world. No, just no. I'd ditch any man, prince or not, if he wanted to dress in skirts for me, all legs and no brains. Let's get down to business, all right? I can show you a world where trees weep for their fallen and bellies growl more fiercely than dragons. Only thing I do when asked, do you really think you can change things? The next poem is called The Unsanitary Truth of the Situation. Saw open my skull, release the insects, witness the colors that bloom below the forget-me-nots. Buried beneath the grime and grease of neglect, hear the fervent sound of a hummingbird's wings beating like a healthy heart, swollen with the irrepressible need to explore more than just the back of my skull. And this poem is about New Zealand, so you'll hear some of my adventures. It's called Adventure Is Out There. Creative, I know. As far as my ticket can take me, from pesticide lawns and nights at the bowling alley, 14,923 kilometers from home, where moonlight paints my skin as the waves graze over my hiking boots, 2,291 meters to the summit of doom upon Mount Narahoe, I climb over black, jagged rocks frozen in angry contortions of the molten lava that rained the Tongariro Valley 20,000 years ago. Now I stand above the clouds. 400 meters below the surface in the Waitomo Caves, my head torch reflects off the calcium carbonate, golden like cake batter, as I army crawl through shocking ice water, chest scraping the ground and helmet clipping stalactites. The tunnel tries to swallow me. I wrench my gumboots from the stalagmite hold. I leave only fear behind in that casket. Fun fact, gumboots are rain boots in New Zealand. Just FYI. This is another NZ poem. It's called Stone Walls. Mother, I spilled my dress on apple juice again today, and then at recess, I muddied my shoes running through the woods as a warrior on horseback, shooting arrows at highwaymen and dodging ogres, while the other girls played hopscotch. Mrs. Arsenault made me write my name on the stone wall with chalk until the dust covered my stain as if it had never existed. Father, can you see those mountains over there? 2,500 years ago, they have stood, and today I climb them with bare feet, slipping in the ashes of time and pausing to snack on an apple. I sliced my fingers on the icy snow, and the volcano drank my blood. At the crater, I screamed my name. This poem is called Third Wheel. Your bedroom door clicks, a final shut. The stairwell announces my escape, boots slapping every step. I yearn for my tattered blanket, like the broken child on the couch that was too big for just me. I race against my folly and the footsteps that follow. This is a fun poem. It's called Keep Your Enemies Closer. I suppose it's more fun for me. Bouncing on his Converse toes, he wears my pride like a cloak. My stomach constricts as he grins, flaunting his freedom. Fallen naked from Pride Rock, I crane my neck to look up at him. My muscles have been knotted for days, and it pains me to stand tall. His loud voice calls down for attention, shifting his eyes to me, but never his words. I have nothing to say anyways. Once he decides he's the party favorite, he cocks his head to the side and pats my hair like a pet. I do my best not to throw a right hook to his smug chin, while I resist kissing his neck. He hints that he doesn't want to go home alone tonight. He can fucking deal. Thanks, Chloe. Pardon my language, I do apologize. It's just what comes out. It's really not part of my common language. You can ask anyone who knows me. Okay, so this next poem is called Please God. I pray with hands over my ears and thorns in my mouth that choke me, and I spit them out. But he clamps his hands on my jaw and forces me to chomp until they crawl down my throat. They carve the words I must not speak into the flesh of my esophagus. Rivers of blood trail down my pipes and swim in the pool of bile where my prayers are boiled down while the excess waste of my heresy is dumped from my mortal body. Please, God, I want some more. And this next poem is called He Kisses Like Spider-Man. I squished his socks into his shoes and rolled his shirts to save room. I packed 6 pairs of shoes. I had only ever seen him barefoot. The Beatles reminded me of where he's going as I folded his maps of New Zealand and packed them alongside our last moments. He came to stand behind me, and I leaned against his legs. Since you can't go more than 5 hours without tea, he offered me chamomile and chocolate while he entertained me with a Rubik's Cube, which he can unscramble in under a minute ever since he took 3 tries and got to its center like a Tootsie Roll Pop. Stroking my face like a kitten, he asked, "What is your favorite sound?" Now he cuddles a stuffed dragon named Daisy while counting the 3,207.77 miles between us and listens to the leaves in the wind. And this is my final poem. I thank you for listening so kindly to my poetry this evening. This is another New Zealand poem. If you're afraid of heights, I recommend you leave the room. Because I'm afraid of heights. Okay. This is entitled, This Wingless Body. Living on the edge has never been so well defined. Straps tighten around my ankles. My voice recedes into my stomach. The Maori staff practice small talk, asking about my hometown and if everyone owns guns. I want to tell him, no, that's Texas. But my lips refuse to move. He tells me to get on the edge, and now I will tell him anything he wants to hear about Texas. I penguin shuffle like a prisoner. My boots toe the line, and I fear I will fall before I am ready. I keep my spine straight to prevent my body from collapsing over the edge. He points to the camera, and I grimace into the sun. Put your hands above your head and have fun. I don't miss his sarcasm. The world is about to meet me, and my body feels heavy, firmly planted. My friends' cheers arch across the river. I can do this. I will do this. I just need a moment. Wait. But life doesn't wait, and neither does my Maori staff. This is not stumble and catch yourself. There is no turning back. This is free fall. An inhuman shriek erupts somewhere behind me. It trails back to the pit of my stomach, which I left on the platform behind me. Jaw clamped, I race along the pale stone cliff face, threaded with deep green veins toward the river's embrace. Eyes open, I defy gravity and bounce back to the sky. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Megan. Of course you counted how many kilometers you were from home. How many? How many kilometers were you from Beverly or from home? Shouldn't you have been more than that? Yeah. Anyway, I'll be brooding over that. Emily Pineau is our final reader. Emily's work has already been honored in lots of different places. Just recently she read on NPR, and I was realizing, Emily, that I never can remember what year you are, which is a compliment. Ever since I've had her in class, I thought she was a senior, and that's been several years in a row. I think you might be a junior this year. Yeah, okay, good. So, Emily Pineau.
Well, the bad thing about going last is I have to follow everybody that was so great. So, well, I'll do my best. Okay. I'm going to start with the poem, Sharing What is Stolen, which is the first poem in my book, No Need to Speak. When you think about it, or don't think about it, or refuse to think at all lines, all of the lines are stolen, because all words have been used before us. We all share these words, and all us writers do is simply organize them into phrases and sentences and make us feel these stolen feelings that have already been felt before from someone else's life and words and meaning that poured from their pen and their mouth and their skin all over onto the next life in which we share, yet it is still stolen because it is recycled and used, and it isn't ours because it was theirs. So we speak these words that have been wrinkled and sweated in, and we write our names in them, staking our claim when we have none at all, because they are stolen. And we didn't pay for the copyright or make monthly payments to the dead, so therefore we are not legally entitled to speak or write anything at all in any order, because we are all breathing stolen time. And the sixth one is called, I Notice Something or a Moth. A moth on a wall is shaped like an upside-down heart. Does the moth even have a heart? Imagine how small it would be. No one seems to love moths or want them in their house. People just see that dark, upside-down heart on their plain white wall, and they swat at it. Then they continue to chase it until they see the guts on a tissue or their cat gets it. We do not want to share our expensive wool coats with the moths. We do not want to share our light bulbs with the moths. We do not allow moths to touch our hearts, but we get to crush theirs. And my third poem is called, I Would For You. I could never seem to get up those steps fast enough as I took out the key I had to your apartment that your mom gave me. Soon I'd know those steps better than I know most people. That summer smell drove all your neighbors' dogs crazy, and they would always stick their noses between my toes and behind my knees. I remember when I had sunburned thighs and I walked into your kitchen. Jack jumped on my legs and his claws dug into my red skin. I think it's kind of funny that your dog greeted me with kisses more often than you did. Once in a while, I cleaned your room and made your bed when I waited for you and your mom to come home from work. You always left your mattress naked and your sheets wrapped up in your blankets on the floor with all your lumpy pillows half under the bed with no pillowcases on them. I wanted to untangle you. I wanted you to come home to something that was put together so maybe you would feel like you were put together. Okay. And my next poem is called All Over the News. A math teacher in Danvers was stabbed by a 14-year-old boy in a bathroom of their school. A bathroom. What a horrible place to die. Imagine dying in a bathroom. That is the last thing you see. Stalls, the sinks, the writing on the walls, the mirror. You see the mirror. You see yourself. The next poem is called By the Light. I feel like streetlights are not written about as often as they should be. They create the mood of the streets. Streetlights hold so much energy, and they're often painted in late night scenes like in Paris, or outside in a cafe in some cute town. But where is the literature of streetlights? Where are the poems and the novels and the memoirs and the short stories dedicated to streetlights? I think someone should go outside late at night and only write by the light of the streetlight. Next poem is called Made for You. I was made to fit in your arms, people say, and write and coo. This is the only cliche I think could be made to be not so predictably sentimental. Think about the way we as human beings have evolved over thousands of years, and then stretch your imagination and think, what if our bodies evolved in such a way that only our soulmates could fit into our arms? And I'll read two more poems. This one is called White Picket Fences. Today I asked my mom if she would accept me in my life if I had an unconventional relationship, never got married, and had a baby from a donor. She told me to stop looking so far ahead. Finish college first, she says. But I need to know, I tell her. I need to know right now. What if I don't have a white picket fence type of life? I need to know. She looks up from folding her laundry, and a towel is flat across her arms. I hate, she says, as she meets each corner of the towel together, white picket fences. The last poem I'm going to read is called Hey, You're a Writer Now. I am not a writer. In fact, I'm starting to wonder if I'll ever really be able to call myself one. And now that I think of it, I'm not even sure what it means to be one. If I get published once, what does that make me? What if it's just an article or a poem, a short story? What if I get published twice or three times in a magazine, a newspaper, online? What if someone reads it or no one reads it? What if everyone reads it? Do I have to write a novel to be a writer? If that novel never gets published, does that make me an almost there kind of writer? What about a book of poems? Am I a poet then? Am I a poet right now? What if I write something, people read it, people love it, and then I never write again? Could I stop being a writer, or is it a permanent kind of thing? Once a writer, always a writer. What if people start to realize I'm not any good at all, and I'm suddenly surrounded by people who are better? Maybe I have been surrounded all along. I could write for my entire life and never call myself a writer. I'd keep on telling people I want to be one, like I'm waiting for someone to knock on my door one day and say, hey, you're a writer now. But then what? I'm a writer now, so now what do? Is the title that important, or is it a profession or an obsession? But what if I'm not getting paid to write, or never get paid to write? Does money have something to do with this? At what point will people stop asking me who I want to be and start asking me who I am? I know who I am, but I'm not sure what to make of myself. I can't put it into words. I start comparing myself to other people. It's easy to call someone else a writer because they are someone else. Some people even look like writers. I wonder if a stranger would think I was a writer. I do not think I'm a writer. I am someone who writes. I am someone who loves to write. The Wikipedia definition of a writer is a person who produces non-fictional writing or literary art such as novels, short stories, poetry plays, screenplays, or essays, especially someone who writes professionally. I do not write professionally. Dictionary.com says a writer is a person engaged in writing books, articles, stories, etc., especially as an occupation or profession, an author or journalist. I do not get paid to write, so I guess I'm not an official writer. What does it mean to be official anyhow? It's not like I wear a badge or carry a license to be a writer. It's not like I would have a certificate or a written document. I just have the understanding of what I am. I want that. I want to understand what I am. So maybe if someone someday does knock on my door and says, hey, you're a writer now, I will ask them why. Maybe they can give me answers. So that when someone does ask me what I am, I won't tell them. I'll tell them to guess. And they'll know that I'm a writer because it will be written all over my face.